We've got Derek Jensen this week on Bottom Up Radio Network. I don't know what's going on with my soundboard here, but it's nice to be back, everybody. So welcome to the Burn Network. That was Twisted Sister with the all-time greatest anthem of resistance, We're Not Gonna Take It. And this week we've got Derek Jensen on the show. I'm sure you know who Derek is. But for those of you who have not heard, well, is that G20 I hear?
Yeah, it was me, clearing the cigarette throat.
Oh, I feel good. I feel great. I'm ready to talk.
I could quit any time.
Yeah. Fucking love. I got laryngitis.
snap.
Man. Let's see. What's on the plan here? What are we?
What do you want to do tonight?
The same thing we do every night. Try to take over the world.
Oh, fuck yeah.
We'll take you in the brain there. Yeah, so
love that
I guess
shit.
We should give him an introduction quick. This is Derek Jensen, everybody. He's going to be joining us later on in the show. And this is just some of the ideas he'll be talking about.
If I can get across one thing in my work, it would be that the culture is a culture of occupation. And the government is a government of occupation. And of course, all of my American Indian friends say, what the hell took you so long to figure this one out? And what does a government of occupation do? It moves in, takes resources, and doesn't care about communities. And if aliens came down from outer space and they were systematically deforesting the planet and they were vacuuming the oceans and they were putting docks in every mother's breast milk and they were giving people cancer and they were causing all these other problems, but we did get tomatoes in January, then we would know exactly what to do. We would put on our camo outfits, we would grab our AK-47s, and we would start picking them off one by one. If it was Islamo-fascists who were putting in all these dams, if they were commie pinkos who were putting in all these dams, we would know what to do. But instead, because we pledged allegiance to the flag, then we identify with the system, and suddenly we get really, really stupid. If we were, it's like, and it's just absurd, the responses that we're supposed to do, that are supposed to be helpful. So what would partisans, Russian partisans in World War II, you know, what would they do if someone was, if the German military was putting in a road and they didn't want the road to go in there? What would they do? They would destroy the road. And if they were putting in a bridge that they didn't want, that was going to be useful to the Germans, what would they do? They would blow it up. And then if the Germans built it again, they would blow it up again. And if the Germans built it again, they would blow it up again. And what do? We file lawsuits. We hold signs. We hold candles. We pray. We send loving kindness. And it's just ridiculous. It's absurd. And it's because we identify. We buy into the system.
So that's Derek Jensen, who's going to be joining us later on the show.
He's a fucking badass.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty good and should be pretty funny. I do want to mention that the guest line will be open at some point in the discussion with Jensen, but it will not be open the whole time simply because I know that there's a lot of people out there that want to call in and tell Jensen he's their favorite author. But, you know, we're not going to be doing that. We're going to get some ideas out first and then have you call in. Yeah.
That sounds great. keep that shit short, dogs.
Well, what should we do right now? Should we go move on to the headlines? Or
let's fucking talk
actually,
headlines.
You know what? Before we set the headlines, I do want to shoot a quick thank you for that last clip to Reverend Dr. Mason Bilderberg, who assisted with the piracy of that clip from the internet and assisted in cutting it shorter. That way it fit on the time frame allowed. So I want to play real quick before we go to headlines a free commercial by Dr. Reverend Mason Bilderberg.
Be ruthless, take risks, vandalize only what must be defaced, do something children will remember all their lives, but don't be spontaneous, unless the poetic terrorist muse has possessed you. Dress up, leave a false name, be legendary. The best poetic terrorism is against the law, but don't get caught. Art as crime, crime as art.
All right, that message brought to you by Reverend Dr. Mason Bilderberg and the unknown entity which seeks to destroy all that which exists to destroy. So let's move on now, I guess, huh? You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready, man. I'm ready to kick it large. You know, last week I was a little nervous, a lot of energy. Now I'm bringing it down a level. You know, I'm bringing something new to the table. I'm going to blow people's minds. I'm going to blow people. So
right here, live on air. It's like the fucking anarchist Howard Zinn. I mean, Howard Stern.
All right, we ready?
Kick it away.
All right. Damir Jamal's Mideast Dispatches reported recently that an Afghanistan war resistor has been sentenced. Sergeant Travis Bishop with U.S. Army's 57th Expeditionary Signal Battalion pled not guilty with court-martialed. So if you disagree with the war, that's just fine. Just don't do it if you're in the military. Right. And we're going to be posting links to these things, folks, so if you want to read them for yourself, please do. Don't take our word for it. The EPA restarts project that contaminated Hudson River. That's an unfortunate thing. The EPA is out to save you. Boston is eyeing wood fuel, as reported in the Boston Herald, and some activists are seeing red. My favorite one, a girl recently was fined $50 by the city for selling lemonade in Central Park. So look out, if you're looking to sell juice, you fucking kids, you might get busted.
I'm going to kill that background music because it was disrupting. I couldn't hear everything you were saying.
Oh, well, it wasn't anything important.
It was
anyway.
Karaoke version of U2, man.
You know, that sounded good on paper.
It did. It sounded awesome.
All right, gang. Well, don't worry. Schwarzenegger has recently toured the devastation after a prison riot.
Get to the chopper!
Finally!
All day to use that way.
I've been waiting all day. I had that shit queued at the 3-second mark on the YouTube, and it really worked great. Hey, Blackwater's in the news again. They're not just protecting politicians, they're also fucking kids. Press TV recently reported that Blackwater, quote, used child prostitutes in Iraq. Don't feel bad, because they do. And finally, Social Security. Social Security is going to shrink again. Cost of living expenses will not be factored into future Social Security checks. For all of those of you who have been double taxed and are living on these checks, they're about to get smaller. And that's it for my headlines, my brother.
All right, yeah. Yeah, it was funny. We were discussing that article earlier, and it didn't make sense the way we were reading it before. Travis, you had said to me that the checks were going to shrink. What was it? How was it worded before that we had it wrong?
Well, I thought they were going to shrink due to the cost of living purportedly going down for the elderly, and we didn't really that. It sounded really weird, but sounded something
well,
like what
the
they
way,
might
the way
do.
We said, the way we originally read it was that. Stocks are going to shrink because cost of living is going that the checks are going to shrink because stocks cost of living is going up, and it didn't make sense, but at the same time it made absolute sense that they would do that. Remember, we were like well, logically this makes no sense, but absolutely this is exactly what they would say. So in my headlines, I wanted to talk about a group called Freeport-McMoRan. Freeport McMoRan is one of the largest mining companies in the world. They're based in Phoenix, Arizona. And let's see, the article that I have for them that I found was that their stocks are predicted to shoot through the roof, predicted by everybody's friend, you're in mine, the people of – oh, damn it. Hold on, I'm losing the article here. It's coming up, everybody. This is a professional news show here.
Yeah.
It's Goldman Sachs while this loads. The stock analysts at Goldman Sachs predict that the stocks will rise for Freeport-McMoRan. And basically what they're saying in this article that I found here is that they expect a rapid acceleration in copper demand, and the stocks are going to rise for this company that mines copper because they are – able to, they've been listed on the quote America's Conviction Buy list which means this is like important stock to buy right now, apparently, because this company is the most ruthless company in the history of companies for mining. I don't know what that is.
That was my shit. The professional radio show again.
Thank you. But to illustrate how this language works, I found this great clip coming from some stock investment company puts out a YouTube video, and it's got this pretty little person talking head talking about stocks, and just listen to what they say really quick here.
Hi Def Investor. Today's investment idea is a long-term play for you aggressive investors. Commodities have run up a lot in the past couple of quarters as the global economy has taken a beating. Now, as it recovers and inflation becomes an issue, commodities will remain popular and actually should continue to grow. For this reason, we've selected a joint commodity stock known as FCX, the Freeport MacMoran Copper and Gold Incorporated. Now, Freeport MacMoran is a copper, gold, and molybdenum mining company, and they actually control reserves of some 100 billion pounds of copper, 40 million ounces of gold, and 2.5 billion pounds of molybdenum. They are currently the number two copper company in the world behind Codelco, but they are the world's largest publicly traded copper company. Its 91% owned subsidiary, PT Freeport Indonesia, actually operates the vast open-pit Grasberg gold, copper, and silver mine in Indonesia, leaving their only competition as the government, who owns the other 9%.
Okay, was that coming through? Could you hear that?
Yeah, I could. And by the way, listener and co-host, how do I sound? Is my voice coming in a little better?
Yeah, you sound delightful.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
No, really. I want to be inside of
that. No, dude. I am. Fuck it. Let's jerk off. We're going to take 2 minutes, folks. We're going to jerk off real quick. We'll be right back.
Well, okay, so...
Anyway.
I'm blushing. so basically, if you couldn't hear what was being said there, I'm going to post this video up in the chat room. One of the things that was astounding to me was how proudly she proclaimed that this company has 91% of the land base for mining in this, controlling 91% of the economy for this land base. The only other 9% is the government, which, of course, you know, we think the government is a lump of shit used by power, and I think this illustrates it even more at how incompetent it sounds when a people's-run company, which is what a government is touts itself to be, controls 9% of the land base use of their minerals. And by the way, they're just completely destroying the world everywhere. You can go to Freeport McMoran's website, which is, I believe it is FXC.com, if I'm not mistaken. Try that, FCX.com. And let me know what you see. But you should see a beautiful picture of a gaping bullet wound in the side of Mother Earth. And they're touting this as being the longest standing, geographically diverse company, meaning that they've been unchallenged since they started, and they've destroyed more land than anybody else. And
along with that, rabble, we should tell them about check out their link on diversity, and you'll find a beautiful picture of a little black girl. That's how you know they care.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, well, I mean, I think it's important to put that face on things when we're trying to show people that we're enlightened and we're open. Next in the articles here that I have for the headlines, the G20 resistance is building for Pittsburgh. And many times in my career of working with anarchist groups, I constantly hear from the liberal side how ineffective anarchism is, how idealistic and nuanced it is. Well, this article seeks to reaffirm that. But right now with the G20 resistance, the city of Pittsburgh has requested 4,000 additional police officers because of their discovering the knowledge that anarchist groups are going to be involved in what was otherwise peaceful organizations to demonstrate peacefully in the streets. So the fact that they're asking for 4,000 more people and using anarchists as their reasoning for that shows us right there that as small as our numbers may be, comrades, we are effective and we are frightening as shit. And I think there's a lot of reasons why we are frightening. You know, the decentralization, the vast amount of claims that the anarchists are making. It's not a – we aren't holding signs asking for one reform. These things are frightening, and we need to use this as a reminder to keep it up, the fact that they're willing to put out in the open that they're so scared of us they need 4,000 more pigs in the streets. And they actually sought some consultation from the chief of police in let me find the article. The chief of police, who was the chief of police in Seattle during the WTO, and he had a great quote that I thought was just spoke volumes. It says, quote, "It was the cop in me who okayed the use of chemical agents, but the police chief in me should have vetoed the decision," he said. So it was the pig in him who said it's okay to gas people with deadly chemicals, but it was the boss in him who thought maybe he should control those pigs. Even the cop is willing to admit that cops don't use human rationale. It was the cop in me who okayed the use of chemical agents. I want to repeat it over and over. It was the cop in me that okayed the use of chemical agents. It was the cop in me who okayed the use of chemical agents. So even the cops say that the cops really don't give a shit. And then the last article hinging on that is the RNC 8. This local hero journalist by the name of John Tevlin in Minneapolis. This goes out to you, you cocksucking fuckhead. He spent a day with the RNC 8, and let me just read to you a couple of the lines here in this professional writer, right? I'm going to read one paragraph to showcase, number one, that he's a horrible fucking writer, and number two, he's a complete dick. "It was a nice afternoon, and sun filtered through the low windows. They were decent kids from good families, earnest, smart, and hard to dislike. They reminded me of some of my friends at that age, back when we were equally idealistic and naive. They also reminded me at times of people who bring weapons to town hall forums." Yeah.
Keep it coming. Yeah. That's my favorite part. Anymore.
Okay, I think that's it. Okay, and then the last thing I wanted to talk about was Jim Hightower's recent article about the anti-Starbucks Starbucks. Apparently, folks, Starbucks has decided that it's uncool to be Starbucks, so they're putting in millions of dollars into opening new stores that make use of all Starbucks products, are funded by Starbucks, will profit Starbucks, but have absolutely no indication that they are Starbucks anywhere whatsoever. You won't find a Starbucks logo even on the coffee bags of the coffee they're using. And they're going for this independent feel, this like bottom-up feel. And I don't know, where is that familiar that I've heard of a large entity using the language of bottom-up and appealing to people trying to claim that they're anti-something?
It rhymes with Barack Obama.
Still not getting it.
No,
yeah.
Not so much.
Maybe
he's handsome.
Let's just play a song.
Okay, let's do it.
We're going to go to a song right now, and then when we get back, we should have our guest tonight, Derek Jensen. This goes out to Reverend Dr. Mason Bilderberg and Kratz.
Real this time around. Technique. Revolutionary volume 2. It's on now, motherfucker. Lock and load. Over turn, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. And fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out than get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfuckers made me out of self-righteous hatred, and now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix, a suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow, lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, you not ready. This is the point of no return and nobody can stop it. Malcolm Little when he knelt before Elijah Muhammad. The comet that killed the dinosaurs changing the earth. They love to criticize, they always say I changed for the worse. Like prescription pills when you misusing them, nigga. The Templar Knights when they took Jerusalem, nigga, and figured out what was buried under Solomon's temple. Al-Aqsa, the name is not coincidental. I know too much, the government is trying to murder me. No coming back, like cutting your wrists open vertically. How could the serpent be purposely put in charge of the country? Genetic engineered sickness spread amongst me. My people are so hungry that they attack without reason, like a fucking dog ripping off the hand that feeds them. Immortal technique is treason to the Patriot Act. So come and get me, motherfucker, cause I'm not coming back. This is the point from which I can never return. And if I back down now, then forever I burn. This is the point from which I can never retreat. Cause if I turn back now, there can never be peace. This is the point from which I will die, succeed, live in a struggle. I know I'm alive when I bleed. From now on, it can never be the same as before. Cause the place that I'm from doesn't exist anymore. This is the point of no return, nigga. You better believe this. Mary Magdalene giving birth to the children of Jesus. The evolution of the world, bloody and dramatic. Human beings killing monkeys to conquer the planet. The kingdoms of Africa and Mesopotamia. Machine gun in your body with depleted uranium. This is the age of microchips and titanium. The dark side of the moon and contact with aliens. I started out like Australians, criminal minded. Broke into hell, tore it down and built the city behind it. Southpaw, murderous methodology, nigga. Remember that I'm just a man, don't follow me, nigga. Cause once you pass the point, you can never go home. You gotta face the possibility of dying alone. So tell me, motherfucker, how could you die for the throne when you don't even got the fucking heart to die for your own? It rains acid, one day the earth will cry from a stone. And you'll be looking at the world living inside of a dome. Computerized humanity living inside of a clone. This is the place where the unknown is living and real. Wormwood, the planet X and the seven seal. Universal truth is not measured in mass appeal. This is the last time that I kneel and pray to the sky. Cause almost everything that I was ever told was a lie. This is the point from which I can never return. And if I back down now, then forever I burn. This is the point from which I can never retreat. Cause if I turn back now, there can never be peace. This is the point from which I will die, succeed, live in the struggle. I know I'm alive when I bleed. From now on, it can never be the same as before. Cause the place that I'm from doesn't exist anymore.
Everybody, that was Immortal Technique. The song is Point of No Return. Technique's got some really great stuff out there, and you can find most of it online for free if you know what you're doing. If you don't, I'm going to tell you real quick. Go to YouTube, put in the name of any singer-songwriter artist that you think might have a song on there, then take that URL, put it into vid2mp3.com, and boom, you got yourself a high-quality MP3. And that's exactly... not exactly how we do it here on this show. We obtain all rights for everything that we use and pay a great sum to BMG and Asrash.
Because we love to support the arts.
Yeah, we don't do anything illegal here. But if you were to, that would be a good way to do it. So we're just we got 1 minute left until we're going to get our guest tonight. G20,
Michael, I want to ask you a question real quick. Sorry, rabble. I want to ask you a question real quick. How's your butthole?
Who's Michael? Oh, geez, are you a cop or something?
No, seriously, how's your butthole?
It's good. It's really good. My butthole's
okay.
It's functioning properly now.
Okay.
I had a case of the CIA flu there for the last few days. But you stole your
kid's vaccine, thank God. So.
Yeah. Well, I do have a daughter in school for that reason. So. I've been teaching her how to tongue her pills since a very young age to bring them home to dad, so it works great.
So, yeah.
All right.
James Cameron's new movie looks pretty cool.
Shut up. Speaking of films, I just saw last night we went to see – we'll do a little film review here. This is a new segment on Burn, actually. This has all been building up to this on purpose. I went to see Inglourious Basterds last night, and let me just say this, that if you put a Nazi – uniform on somebody, you can torture them in any film and nobody will throw a fit. It's fucking phenomenal, the amount of torture that has taken place in this movie against these Nazi shitheads. And, you know, nobody in the audience seemed to be a bit uncomfortable with it. It was awesome. People were cheering to see a knife enter the flesh at a very slow pace repeatedly. And so it was. It's interesting.
You know,
what
if it's
think.
If it's Nazis or Jesus, nobody cares. It's totally fine. So.
Oh my gosh. So we got a call on line two. Hello, caller.
Hey, this is Derek.
Derek who?
I'm supposed to be. I believe I got the right number. I'm supposed to be interviewed on the radio.
Yeah, I've never heard. Is this Derek Jensen?
Yeah.
Oh, the Derek Jensen. Who?
Oh, we were fucking with you, Derek. We were trying to.
We're fucking with you. It was supposed to be this funny little bit where we pretended like we didn't know who you were.
God, Travis.
Well, you had me going. I was like, I don't know what I was going to do.
So, you know, if it's okay, Rabble, I have a question that I would like to ask Derek. And I think, honestly, and it's my hope, Derek, that this question doesn't end up dominating our entire time with you on the show. But I, you know, I've looked over your books. I'm currently reading Railroads and Clear Cuts, and I just want to ask you this. Please be honest. It might be uncomfortable. Dungeons and Dragons, 4th edition, go.
Well, see, I'm going to reveal my age because, or my out of touchedness because I don't even know what 4th edition is. So here's the deal. What I get to do, though, is I get to talk about the fact that when we played, back when we had to walk 18 miles to school, we started with the three little itty-bitty booklets, and then
which were published by Satan, by the way.
I'm not
making that up. My mom told me that a lot, and I couldn't watch the Smurfs either because apparently he not only produced books, but he produced and directed animation as well.
Don't forget to add Mighty Mouse because of the cocaine thing.
No, Mighty Mouse was fine because he beat up women.
Mighty Mouse
kids were allowed to watch that.
Anyway, back, you know, it's interesting. The whole Dungeons and Dragons thing, which I enjoyed very much as when I was younger, is that I probably still like it if these days. But anyway, the thing that blew me away once I started to get politicized when I was a little bit older is what a great model that is for actually civilization. Because the orcs and goblins and all them, we used to go around and just sort of gleefully slaughter, you know, anybody that was basically non-human or declared to be bad. And so if you just consider the orcs and goblins as, you know, sort of the white perspective on indigenous peoples, it ends up being a really, really interesting exercise in the colonial mindset. Not to try to ruin our fun here, but...
Yeah, Jesus.
Sorry about that.
Well, you know what's funny about that is I don't play D&D because I have sex. And
you asshole.
But Travis does, and so I wanted to become closer to G20 sided die over there, who actually even got his name from D&D. So I looked up insults from D&D on the internet, and what you were saying about kind of the indigenous cultures and maybe even taking into race issues, it's very similar. The insults to use against each other in D&D is very similar to the insults used in hip hop and gangster rap. I think you got something there.
I'd
like to see gangster rappers using those insults. I'd like to see Ludacris bust out with that against Jay-Z or something. I think it would be pretty sick to call him
a fucking half-shaving
goblin, you know?
You fucking half-drow.
Right.
Yeah.
It's all about the percentiles. Dog.
Shit. Fine.
Okay,
let's
we got
talk about let's,
on the line here. Come on, let's talk about some
let's talk about the fucking end of the world and fucking salmon and birds and shit. Fine.
So, Derek.
Well, anyway, actually, what I would love to see is an anti-Civ or anti-Empire D&D. It's like Half-Life. I have to admit, I really like the plot of Half-Life. You know, it's all about...
Or Second Life?
No, Half-Life. Half-Life.
My God,
Derek,
I'm so out of touch here.
Derek, I'm falling in love with you crazily right now. Please continue.
But... The plot is really strongly, you know, anti-empire, anti-state oppression. And then Doom 3, which is, I don't know if there's any Doom 4 yet, but Doom 3, the plot is actually very strongly, what happens is they are doing these excavations, and they're messing around with, I think, some genetically modified stuff, I don't remember, and they open up the gates to hell, and it's a great metaphor. And I think those are actually pretty interesting. So I would love to see a D&D that was strongly anti-empire and based on resistance, and then have kids from about, you know, age 10 up just start playing those.
But see, we'd have to make it non-hierarchical, because I remember clearly going to lunch every day in my biology teacher's room, because that's how cool I was, and also in the lunchroom was the D&D kids, and I tried to play their little game with them one week, and, you know, I was like, oh, well, they're here every day, I'll play with them. And they wouldn't even let me play because I just couldn't. That's how hierarchical the most nerdy group in school are. They wouldn't even let me play. So it would have to be a non-hierarchical based game. And otherwise, I can't play.
Hey, if anybody can figure out, it's Hasbro.
Yeah, well, they'll figure out how to sell it for sure.
Right. Yeah, right.
Speaking of that, Derek, I want to touch on some of the stuff you talk about in Volume 2 of Endgame and Resistance, because
okay.
I think that the Endgame is one of the greatest, albeit most Russian in its style, manifestos that coming out of any generation in American literature. And I'm not just saying that because I think you're cool. I'm saying that because, I mean, it's like reading a Russian novel. I mean, my God, it's a 900-page manifesto, and you end it by saying that that's not even done yet. Some of the things you talk about in here that I think are hot-button topics for people within the I don't even want to say the anarchist community or the underground community, because that sounds so stupid because it's so fucked up. But the eating meat and the purchasing and all these things, this is a lot of the stuff going around right now, critiques of you, and I know you hear it all the time. And I'd like to hear people – hear you talk about those critiques of the anti-civilization versus civilization movements, and how does that fit? How does that work?
Well, a couple of things. First off, I want to thank you for saying the Russian style thing, because even though Dostoevsky's politics bug me quite a bit, I love Russian novels, and I love a lot of Russian novels, and so that makes me really happy. Nobody's ever said that to me before, and it makes me happy that you said that. Next is I understood what you were saying in general, but I wasn't sure. There's a couple, three different directions you went with the question. So can you tell me which direction you're wanting me to address?
Yeah, well, I think that what we see a lot is people having to feel that the personal responsibility issue comes into play immediately because, you know, especially within white liberal groups who become radicalized. They automatically want to take personal responsibility for saving the world. And you're saying in your book that, no, don't focus so much on personal responsibility. Those are great things, but it's not your fault. There is somebody at the top who needs to be taken down. But it sounds a little bit like that you're using it not you necessarily, because you talk about this openly, but a lot of people use that as their excuse for continuing to support these regimes, continuing to do the things they do.
Well,
as opposed to using it as a stepping point.
Yeah. And that's a really great question that gets to the heart. Well, I think it's not quite as great as a D&D question, but it's pretty close.
Edit me. Make it a great question.
Well, if we can bring in a D20, then it'll be great.
Oh, snap, Mitch. Let me get my dice.
Again, I'm left out of the conversation.
Okay. Anyway, I think that's really in many ways the question. It's one of the ways that the whole environmental movement, the whole sort of whatever resistance we have, and mainly what resistance we don't have, has gone awry, is that there's this – nobody in their right mind would think that purely personal solutions would have stopped the Nazis or brought down apartheid or anything like that. But so often within the environmental movement, the solutions we're handed are either totally – sort of status, you know, write your so-called representatives, or they are purely personal, like ride a bicycle. And actually, before we go any further, can you Do you hear that? That is, am I coming through okay? Because I can hear like a some static.
No, you're coming through great on
Oh, now the static's gone. The static's gone.
Oh, yeah, I heard that too. That was weird.
Yeah, I think
I hear crickets. I'm sitting out with my door open, and there's crickets. I don't know if that's.
No, that wasn't it. It was definitely. I think the feds were putting static on just to mess with us, and then when they got caught, then they turned it off. Like, oh,
assholes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. My porch beeps at us occasionally from underneath the porch. And, so I find myself seeing my neighbors talking to my porch, explaining to the feds what a waste of time it is because I have a radio show and a blog and.
Right.
You know, if they just got a library card, they wouldn't have to surveil me. They could just read on the internet. But
hey, exactly. should I worry about the black van out in front of my house? I'm sure it's fine. It's probably the 18.
Is it double parked or anything?
No. There's a guy in black sunglasses.
You should definitely call law enforcement and get them to.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the original question. One of the ways we've really gone wrong is by falling into this notion of the purely personal solution. And one of the ways it's happened has been sort of, I think, a systematic campaign. In the 1980s was the first time that the corporate newspaper started referring to human beings more often as consumers than human beings or even citizens. And that's really crucial because if they can get you to define yourself as a consumer, then basically your options for resistance are buy and don't buy. And on the other hand, if you are a citizen, then you can, vote, not vote, boycott, organize, run a radio program. You can, win a government that becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You can alter or abolish it. And then there's an even more wrenching transformation that took place a couple thousand years ago, which is the transformation from human animals who live in community and who have teeth and claws and who require habitat to citizens of a nation state who part of the deal that we make with the state, according to all the sociology, is that we grant the state a monopoly on violence. And so the point is that instead of organizing politically and beginning to form a resistance movement, we go down these dead ends of riding a bicycle or composting or, these purely lifestyle choices that don't really make any large difference. Because really, if the purpose is to reduce your carbon footprint as much as possible, just kill yourself right now because that drops it down to zero. But we can do better than zero, and that's by actually stopping this culture from committing its atrocities. We can start to form a resistance movement. And so really, one of the things I'm trying to get at with that is that, sure, if you want to take shorter showers or whatever, that's fine, but those are really short levers. 90% of the water used by agriculture and I'm sorry, 90% of the water used by human beings is used for agriculture and industry. Only 10% is used by human beings anyway. And of that remaining 10%, there's the same amount of water used by municipal golf courses as are used by municipal human beings. So if you really want to protect water, then taking shorter showers is a really, really, really short lever. And also, what it does is like Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, was a pretty good introduction to global warming, but it's also sleight of hand because at the end of the movie, the solutions they offer have nothing to do with the growth economy. They have nothing to do with the larger superstructure that's killing the planet. They have nothing to do with the corporations that run the planet. They all have to do with inflating your tires, getting compact fluorescence. It's like a bit of stage magic, prestidigitation, because it's like look over here when all of a sudden when the real action is happening somewhere else. And so that's one of the ways that we've gone really, really awry. And there's a great quote that my friend Lee Arkeith says, which is the role of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible. The role of an activist is to confront and take down systems of oppressive power. And
right.
That really cuts to the heart of all of it. I mean, were the Vietnamese going to get
problem.
The United States out of Vietnam by living more simply? It's not going to happen.
That's the biggest problem we see.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I think that's the biggest problem that we see is how the power structure, whether it be the state or the microcosms of the state in the communities or in the homes. You talk a lot about comparisons of violence of the state on down to levels of violence, by by abusive parents or abusive siblings, abusive lovers, and how it's all inherently the same violence of top-down violence. The biggest tool they use is the confusion aspect. They confuse you, and they make it not seem so simple as to where the violence is coming from. When you know it really is stemming from one particular place.
Well, and that's a classic abusive dynamic. Is you know I wouldn't have had to do that to you if you would have washed the dishes correctly. You know I wouldn't have done that if you would have parked in the right place. I wouldn't have done that if you wouldn't have broken the dish. I wouldn't have done that if you would have had dinner on the table. You know.
And I think we still use that dynamic even. Even in the the resistance culture with amongst one another, I know that I've been guilty of using that and participating in conversations around those ideas of pointing blame or diverting blame, which is something I think that it would be great to work on, you know. But I think it has to come from an understanding that we're not quite there yet.
Well, I don't have a problem with assigning blame. I mean, you know, ExxonMobil is pumping out boatloads of carbon emissions, and
I'm not talking necessarily about the ones that are easy. I'm talking about the personal relationship blame. We still use the hierarchical system that's been put into place of diverting blame with one another, as opposed to accepting accountability and responsibility, which is the ultimate goal.
If I can add to that, it's another thing that is another microcosm of that framework is just the simple arguments that erupt over voting versus not voting, and it becomes kind of a byproduct of the machine to, Michael and I were having, sorry, Rabble and I were having a conversation the other day, and we were just talking about, how political discussions make people angry, and when people get angry, their reason gets clouded. And when their reason gets clouded, they act in a way they might not and become disengaged from any true issues.
I disagree with that personally. I disagree that anger clouds your vision.
Well, fuck you.
I think it can go either way, and I'm not trying to be a peacemaker here. But I really think
you're fucking liberal, Jensen. I knew it.
You fucking hope crusher. You are the hope crusher.
I think that it can go either way. That and actually, it's interesting because just last night I wrote a very short paragraph about how I have seen people riding their rage like a fast black horse. I was pretty happy with that line. Riding their rage like a fast black horse, and it's beautiful. And I've seen people with their rage riding them. Holding a white whip, and that is not so beautiful. That's pretty atrocious. And so part of it is, I know for myself that I remember years and years ago, gosh, this is probably 15 years ago now, this one activist said to me that the only things that keep her going are rage and sorrow. And,
That's sad.
Well, I don't know that it is. I think that it just is. And I think that rage can make us very, very clear. And I think that rage can make us very, very confused.
But
and
if it's the only thing that's keeping us going,
No, her specifically. I'm saying
beyond her though. I think a lot of people beyond her feel that way, and a lot of people are forced into feeling that way, and a lot of times we get bogged down because of that, and because none of us that I know of came into the ideas of creating a better world based on the ideas of a better world that we want to create right now, are not based on ideas of rage and sorrow, but on ideas of joy, of great love and great amounts of joy and great amounts of respect for each other, and that we can create that joy in harmony with each other as humans and each other with the planet, with the land base, all of it. I mean, there's a great amount of joy to be had there.
I don't think we're disagreeing at all. And I
right.
think that I think that it's really – I agree with what you said there. And in addition, I don't think that that's contradictory to also feeling – rage. I think that
absolutely.
One of the great things is to attempt to aim that rage and to be outraged at outrageous things and to not be outraged at things that aren't outrageous. So, you know, I can get pissed off. 6 years ago, this woman one time asked me how my anger at the dominant culture affects my sex life. And the I mean, what I really wanted to say is, you know, it's a question to which you're never going to know the answer.
Well, I don't think it's your obsession with the dominant culture. It's that you play D&D.
That's a better question.
Your sex life ended officially once you admitted both your D&D knowledge and your video game knowledge. It's over.
Anyway, the point is that her question was based on the idea that just because I'm angry at the dominant culture, I'm angry at everybody, but I'm not. And, I mean, my God, the three of us have been laughing through this phone call. It's unimaginable, isn't it? Because we're such angry people. But that's part of it. It's like a friend of mine, George Drafin, helped bring Earth First up to Washington State in the early 80s. And he eventually left Earth First. And the reason he did it in the 90s, and what he said was that one of the reasons that he brought it there in the first place is because there were a lot of people who were really angry about what was happening to the forest. And one of the reasons he got out is because there were a lot of people who were really angry, and they happened to have found a place where they could place the anger that they had inside themselves.
Right.
And there's a huge difference there that I see.
So it wasn't based in the anger. It wasn't really based in the anger that they thought it was.
And you know, I'll have to go ahead and admit my own hypocrisy that, you know, what brings me to this and doing this program with Rabble and admiring you, Derek, is that, I mean, it's not like I'm perfectly happy with the system and therefore I'm just going to do this for shits and giggles. I mean, granted, you know, obviously my own anger at the system brought me to the point. More specifically, what I was talking about was, Derek, what you mentioned, kind of anger in the negative, in which case, you know, the guy being dragged out of the city hall thing or the town hall meeting, you know, yelling fascist. I don't believe he's going to go to a healthy place, and I think that the anger he's experiencing in the negative is a natural response to the system, but also an unhealthy response that the system's kind of designed to produce to keep people in kind of the negative arena of anger and keep them distracted.
Well, yeah, I think it's a matter of being able to use your anger for yourself, not allow someone else to use it for their benefit.
Sure.
And not to get all therapeutic on us here, but I think also that one of the really important things is choice. And if someone is choosing, you know, if they're making a decision, you know, if I'm getting tossed out of this room, I'm going to yell fascist because that's what tactically is the best thing to do, that's one thing. If they're doing it simply because they're annoyed, then I'm not sure that, you know, where it may have clouded, you know.
Yeah, but then again, that's questioning an action based on its intention as opposed to just taking the action for the action. I mean, yeah, technically it may not have had the effects that the person intended, but does it really matter? If the action takes place, does it really matter why the person intended that action to happen?
Well, I was going to say, besides which, it's kind of silly what I just said, because if the person's getting hauled out of the room, it really is probably not going to matter to the decisions
right.
being made
what,
in the
what
room.
What choice do they have at that point?
Whether they shout out fascist or whether they shout oogly poogly, you know?
Right, yeah, they can shout peanuts and it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Actually,
which would be
awesome.
Might
be better because going,
tactically,
peanuts,
it would be better.
Peanuts, peanuts. And everybody's like,
what?
that might shut down the meeting for a while.
Yeah, yeah, actually that might have had far more effect. Now that, I'm going to start going to town hall meetings just... Peanuts!
If we had full control over our bowel system, I think this would be an appropriate time to intentionally shit your pants in public because, you know, as a tactic, I think it's great. I mean, they were talking about using that special weapon that makes you shit your pants at riots.
Oh,
I,
yeah.
think that's a, I think that's a great tool. Use it because you just supplied another tool of resistance for thousands of protesters to sling shit at pigs.
Well, every monkey in the zoo knows that.
Yeah, it's great.
I presume you're speaking theoretically.
I actually, to be honest, I don't know if I was or not, because I'm thinking about it now. And
I'm going to Google that shit.
It's disturbing.
Literally.
One of the most fascinating aspects that I found is your the ability that you have to convince people who want to think so badly that they're pacifists based on the definitions of pacifists they've been told. That they're absolutely by the end of reading your book or having a discussion based around one of your books, I've seen more than one people, including myself, come to the point where they say, you know, fuck that. Let's violence is good. it's not the supreme good, but it's not as bad as I thought.
Well, I think it's all circumstantial. I think that there was. Actually, I had a disagreement with somebody not very long ago who was saying that she thought it was arrogant that – she said, how could you possibly suggest that it's ever acceptable to force another person to change their lifestyle. And I said, what about Ted Bundy? You know, part of his lifestyle was killing women. And is it okay to force him to stop? And he's like, well, yeah. And but then she wouldn't take it the next step. And I think that we can all accept that there are some circumstances where it's appropriate to stop someone using violence. There aren't very many people who would not agree with that. And I got interviewed by a pacifist several years ago. It was really horrible. At one point, one of the things I said is that he was saying that all violence is bad. And I said, well, how do you defecate? Because every time you defecate, you kill bazillions of bacteria. And I said, you know, what's your definition of violence? He didn't really have one. He just knew it was bad. And my definition of violence is any act that causes harm to another. And I really like that definition because it shows the ubiquity of violence. Every time, I mean, I had a carrot a little while ago, you know. I ate the carrot, and the carrot, those were living cells. And so what I said to the pacifist guy was, I think under most circumstances, most of us think that it is not acceptable, morally acceptable, to do violence to another human being. And I think under most circumstances, most of us think that it is morally acceptable to do violence to a carrot. And mm-hmm. So what I'm really interested in is trying to figure out where we each individually and where we collectively draw those lines. So, you know, is it acceptable, you know, to you to, would it be acceptable, it would be acceptable to me to, you know, my mom is in another room right now, and if somebody burst in and tried to kill her, it would be absolutely acceptable to me to use violence to stop that person. On the other hand, somebody cuts me off on the highway, it is not acceptable for me to shoot them, you know? So.
And the truth is, though, according to your definition of violence, there are people bursting into your mother's house right now trying to kill her. Not physically in their own being, but there are elements that are being used to try to stifle us all and make us sick and make us dependent, and not just us, but the things around us, the land base around us. And
well,
according to your definition of the land base killing, if the land base goes, the humans go. If they're killing the land base, they are killing your mother, correct?
Yeah, you get it. We're done. Should we talk about D&D some more?
Fuck yeah.
I mean,
shit, I got my monster manual right here. We'll flip through some stats. Shit, it'll be sick.
No, that's it. Keep going if you want, but that's absolutely it. Yeah, I mean, that's part of the thing is you can't get more violent. That's what I ultimately said to that woman is that the woman I was having a disagreement with is that you know, you can't – she was saying it's arrogant to try to think that you can change people's lifestyle well without their permission. And it's like, well, wait a second. What has a dominant culture done to every indigenous culture? What is it doing to the oceans right now?
Mm-hmm.
Where do the salmon fit into this? Where did Delta Smelt fit into this?
Well, the problem is we've
anthropomorphized
– We've always anthropomorphized God to be a human, which is the first, and also to be above us, to be a human who is above us, which inherently, no matter if you're religious now or not, raised in a dominantly Christian culture or dominantly any religious culture, you're always going to hold the position of yourself being below yourself. And if you anthropomorphize God as being human, everything else doesn't fit into that equation, period. Our culture does not, we don't view the land base as being a spiritually bountiful and even dominant creature. The land base is dominant, whether we like that or not. The simple fact that we would not exist if the land base stopped existing tells us that the land base is dominant over our life. But when we anthropomorphize God and take out what other indigenous cultures have taken out, you know, when I went to a Christian school as a kid, I was told, well, they worship the trees. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, but we're reading books written on paper from trees.
Right.
I mean, the Bible is written on a tree, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Actually, I think it was papaya back in the day, but I'm just getting technical and shit.
Yeah, I think that one of the really important things that Christianity did was it was able to, or Judeo-Christianity, the monotheism, let's just go there. One of the things that monotheism did that was really harmful was it extracted all meaning from the earth and it put it out somewhere a long ways away. And that's
mm-hmm.
one of the interesting things that a lot of scientists don't accept is that science is the intellectual heir of Christianity, because basically Christianity removed all meaning from the world and put it way out there, and then science just, you know, turned out the meaning out there, turned off the lights, you know, last one out, turn off the lights and go home. And so basically meaning was removed from the world by monotheism, and then it was removed from the universe by science.
Right. Well, science is the same as religion, is man-made answers to man-made questions.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
that's the simplest definition of either of those things.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say the fundamental difference. I've said this in pretty much all my books. The fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even most open-minded Westerners generally view listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really works. That if I say, you know, the tree said to me, then that would be a perfectly reasonable thing to say among many indigenous cultures, basically every indigenous culture. And for someone to say that in the dominant culture, if you check into a psychological, you know, a mental health clinic, on the intake forms, I've seen these, where there's on the intake forms, one of them says, you know, do you hear voices when there's nobody there? And I was thinking about that. It's like, well, okay, so TV doesn't count because you can hear voices, nobody's there. But on the other hand, the tree doesn't count as a somebody. So if I hear voices when there's a TV, when there's a machine here, but no plants, then I'm not crazy. But if I hear a machine, if I hear a voice when there's plants here but no machines, then I'm crazy. But back to the indigenous thing, I mean, that's the fundamental difference is perceiving the rest of the world as being made up of other beings with whom we enter into relationship as opposed to objects to be exploited. And then what were you going to say?
Well, I just kind of going back a little bit to the nature of violence and what kind of violence is acceptable, I think that, from my point of view, the organization of the state and the corporations who are all in bed with them, the central motivating core at the center of the state is a rotten core, and it's one based on the initiation of violence towards, citizenry and individuals and such. And I think that it's important to look at how I don't want my reasoning to come too close to being the same. The idea that initiating violence is the most effective way to affect social change, because so far, at least in the past 10,000 years, it hasn't really worked. And I think that there are many who kind of say, well, all we have to do is get more guns than them, and then we'll win, and then we'll melt all the guns down, and we'll build a peaceful statue. I think that reasoning leads to more of the same and doesn't affect change. So I think that an important shift, and then I'll shut the fuck up, an important shift that I think needs to happen, and I don't know how it will, I don't claim to, has to be a deeper philosophic shift. And I think anti-civilization represents that maybe a little bit.
I think that that's working on the assumption that violence is what made greedy people greedy, not that greedy people use violence to obtain what they need.
I think greedy people absolutely use violence to get what they need.
But I don't think that violence is what made them greedy.
Well, I think that I'm not just talking about just basic violence. I'm not talking about basic violence. I'm talking about the idea that to affect change, we must initiate force. I think that when that's at the center of our socioeconomic framework, then naturally what will happen is that those who are greedy, because they're going to be greedy anyways, but it's the kid in the candy store type of a framework.
Well, a couple things. One is I don't think it's accurate to say that resistance has never worked. I think that there are some former members of the IRA who would disagree with you, and there are people who live in an Ireland that is not under British rule who would disagree, and I think that there are some South Africans, former ANC members, who would disagree. I think there's some Vietnamese who would disagree, and I think that yes, we can say that for the last 10,000 years nothing has worked because the world's getting killed, but if we say that, then obviously nonviolence hasn't worked either. And
well, I'm not a pacifist. Like my rabble once said to me, he goes, dude, if we're in a bar and someone takes a swing at you, I'm going to break a fucking bottle over his head. And I dig that, and I appreciate it because I'm a pussy and I wouldn't fight back. But that's not because I'm a pacifist. Specifically, you know, all these places in Ireland, they ousted other governments, and that's absolutely true.
Right. And it's important to note the conversation was based about the idea of a cop on the street manhandling one of your friends and not doing anything about it because of their uniform, and in a bar, somebody manhandling one of your friends and you doing something about it. Why? Why is there that fundamental difference? And that's
what I'm saying.
Good to talk about.
I think one of the fundamental differences is if if you hit a cop on the head with a bottle, you're probably going to prison for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I'm not saying that that is a – I'm not saying that – I'm just saying.
Yeah, you said that's
right. That is a consideration.
Are you defending the police, Derek Chen?
I'm simply saying that that would enter anyone's – that would presumably enter almost anyone's mind when they are making that decision in that moment.
And I think that's the thing that we need to overcome.
That, I'm sorry, what?
That's what we need to overcome.
Well, I don't know. And the reason I'm going to say I don't know is because, as you know from all of my work, I think it's circumstantial. I think that there are times, you know, if there are, let's take this out of the United States so that we don't have to worry about anything. And let's make it so we're members of French or Russian or German or Danish or Norwegian or whatever, or Czech, it doesn't matter, resistance to the Nazi regime. And you see an SS officer beating up someone. There are circumstances when it would be absolutely appropriate to pull out a machine pistol and shoot the SS officer, and there are times when it would be appropriate to melt into the background and, you know, he who fights and runs away lives to fight another day. And so I think that there are circumstances. I think that I don't think we can make – but the point is that it becomes not a – it becomes a question of what is the appropriate form of resistance. What is the most effective resistance?
The one that you do at the time, I think. Honestly, I think that the most effective one is not the one you don't do.
Well, it depends. We can certainly do some ineffective resistance.
What I'm saying is the most effective form of resistance is not the one that you do not do. If you refuse to resist in any way.
Oh, right.
Right, then that's the most ineffective. And, you know, I think I
want to say one more thing about armed resistance, too, which is happening right now, which is actually very important, which is men, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, that they've been able to reduce oil production in Nigeria by about 20%. They've been able to knock 20% off, and it's gotten to the point where the oil industry is actually considering leaving the country. And they've been doing this with, this is absolutely impoverished people who tried to work nonviolently for many, many years, and then actually in many ways the murder of Ken Saro-Wiwa by the government was one of the catalysts to turn it over and for them to say, you know, in this case, nonviolent resistance really isn't working. And I want to say one more thing, too, which is really important, which is that no matter whether we're talking about violent or nonviolent resistance. I actually want to say two things. First thing is, no matter what we're talking about violent or nonviolent resistance, we have to remember that those in power really do only understand force. And what I mean by that, and nonviolence as a political tactic is also based on force. It's based on the force of numbers, where one of the ways to think about this is if you have Rosa Parks all by herself sitting on a bus, she wasn't just a random person. She'd been trained, and they were ready. And the entire African-American community got behind her, and they were able to bring the bus company to its knees. It wasn't just because, you know, people thought good thoughts. This was an actual strategy. And if you have the numbers, then nonviolent force can be a perfectly legitimate and effective tool. And then if you don't have numbers, one guy all by himself, acting all alone, almost stopped World War II. It's George Elser. He attempted to assassinate Hitler in 1939, and he very, very nearly did it. If it wouldn't have been raining that night, his bomb would have gone out. He had a bomb set, and because Hitler couldn't fly out because it was foggy, he had to change the time of his fuse, and the timer was already set, and it went off 20 minutes too late. And that would have stopped World War II. Everybody with resistance knows that would have stopped World War II. One guy acting all by himself. So that's a longer lever. In his case, I want to be really clear, I'm absolutely not suggesting that particular tactic against the President of the United States for any number of reasons.
I'm glad that you took the time to announce that you're not suggesting something which I hadn't even inferred.
Well, see, one of the things I've learned is that almost anything I say ends up being taken 300 different ways.
And
right.
You're in court against people, actually. Eric McDavid, they used your books in court, that he had your books on his bookshelf. That had to feel better than getting any book award, by the way.
Well, had he gotten off, it would have felt better. But since he didn't, it felt kind of shitty, frankly.
Well, it is very shitty, but the fact that you are that your words, which are not only just your words, it's important, and I think that I talked to you about talking about that, that you use a lot of source references, a lot of source material, because this isn't just Derek Jensen. This is a movement of thousands or even millions of indigenous and non-indigenous resistance fighters coming together, and Derek Jensen is simply able to channel the words and use his own words a lot of times. But there's a lot of people involved in this, right?
Well, yeah, and you know, I think also about you know, we're holding hands over time and over space, and I can't
That's
remember his name right now, but I know that Maude Gunn was very important in the Irish Land revolt, and she also did a lot of prisoner support. She went to prison herself in England, almost died in a hunger strike. And one of the things she did, her son was one of the commanders of the IRB, right before the IRA, of the predecessor of the IRA. Her son was one of the generals of it. And that's, you know, it's passing on from generation. Ken Sarawiwa, he's dead, and his son, Ken Wiwa, is part of the resistance. And
Fred Hampton Jr.
Actually, I don't know much about that. What's the story?
Fred Hampton Jr. is now one of the spokespersons and council parties for the Poor People's Campaign and other campaigns of black uprising in Oakland and Chicago. And he's a very, very militant voice, much in the way of his father, and he understands clearly what his fate is unless he gets massive amounts of support, because his father was gunned down in his sleep.
Yeah.
Before we move on too much further, Derek, I want to ask, can we take a quick commercial break? I got like a 40-second clip here that I wanted to play that goes along with what you've been talking about and what you talk about in your books. I think you'll enjoy it. And then open this up to some callers. Do you have time for that?
Sure. And let's set what time are we going to be done with the whole thing?
We got about 15 to 20 minutes of talk time with you.
Okay, that's
what we have to be done.
Great.
That work?
That sounds great. So 40 seconds of free commercial.
Yeah. Here we go.
If I bring up Chess Master up here and ask him, what are the principles, Wojciech? I'm become a master of this game of chess. He'll say these four things. He'll say that you need a sense of patience. Now, if you don't have patience, don't even try to begin the game to learn it. He'll say you need a sense of timing. If you don't have a sense of timing, don't open the book. You have to have knowledge of your opponent, right? And then the fourth one that they'll tell you is that you need to have the willingness to make any and all sacrifices. Now, ladies and gentlemen, why on the dark side winning the game? Because they've got infinite patience. They've been working on one thing for 50,000 years. I call that patience. They got a brilliant sense of timing because they know all about the astrology and the divination we've forgotten, that our agricultural ancestors all knew about. Well, we're with the Julian calendar and we're not interested in any of that stuff anymore. We're slaves of the watch, but we don't know about the higher time to rule our own lives by. They have amazing knowledge of you, right? They have intense knowledge of us, their enemies. And the fourth one is the clincher, isn't it? Because they're willing to make any and all sacrifices when and wherever they need to do it.
All right. With that being said, let's take some calls. That was put together by Reverend Dr. Mason Bilderberg as well. These are free commercials. They are not advertising anything but your thought. So let's go. The number is 646-200-3974. G20 and Derek, are you both still there?
That's right.
Okay, so anybody, you're welcome to call in. I know we've got some people in the chat room who've been saying some stuff that I think could bear repeating online for the rest of our listeners to hear. The phone lines are open, 646-200-3974. In the meantime, Derek, what are you working on now? I see that you got you're working with Franklin Torres on a film.
Well, actually, he's doing that. There's actually three different people who are – we're making films about me right now, or about my work, really. And so basically for those, I'm just being interviewed. Those aren't really my projects.
Okay.
I've got 800 bazillion projects going on. I've got a novel coming out in about a month. That's
cool.
About a woman who is like me in that she is, you know, a paper revolutionary. And one night she gets mugged, and as she's getting mugged, she's fairly combative, and she's getting mugged, and she works on toxics in her city. And what I mean by paper revolutionary is that she is working above ground, and she recognizes how messed up the system is. And anyway, so as she's getting mugged by these guys, she gets very upset, and she says, you know, what do you think I'm down here for? You think I belong in this neighborhood? I'm down here trying to save kids from cancer. And you're so tough. You know, you can beat up a woman. You think you're just as bad as the corporation. And what she doesn't know is that one of the guy's little sisters has died of cancer not very long ago, and it's really messed him up. And he thinks about killing her right then, but he doesn't do it. He goes back and he thinks about that for a long time. And he goes up and visits his brothers in the penitentiary, and his brother says, you know, she's right, you know. And he says, if you take some gunpowder and you put it on a table and you light it up, you just got a stink in your house and a burn mark on your table. But if you put that behind a bullet, you got something. And his point is direct your anger, which is what we were talking about earlier. And then later on, she's, you know, several months later, she's sitting in her office, and one of the guys who mugged her comes into her office, and she's working late alone at night. And she says, you know, get out of here. And he says, no, I came to say I'm sorry. She says, fine. Apology accepted. Get out of here. And so, no, I also want to say you're right. It's fine, I'm right. Get out of here. He says, no, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about what you said about how, you know, the system, how it works and everything, and so we did it. And he says, did what? And he says, well, he's out in the trunk. And what he'd done is he kidnapped the CEO of the corporation and put him in the trunk and brought him to her office, because what this does is it now, if she doesn't participate, then it makes clear that everything she's ever said has been, you know, just rhetoric. And if she does participate, of course, she's participating in a capital crime. So I put her in that position, and then we'll see what happens. So that novel's coming out in about a month.
Cool.
So I'm working on a bunch of different projects. I have a children's book coming out in the spring, if you can believe it.
Awesome.
And it's so funny because I read this to the publisher of it. I read the story before he ever saw it or anything. I read the story of it to him, and I finished reading it to him on the phone. It's very short. It's for very young children. I finished reading it, and he's silent for a second, and I said, what's wrong? And he said, no guns. This is Derek Jensen. There's no guns. I had to laugh at that. It's a really cute little story about bears in the forest. And that one's being I'm working on that with Stephanie McMillan. And then with whom I did she's a great cartoonist with whom I did As World Burns. And then also I'm working on a book with Eric McBay and Lear Keith about it's called Deep Green Resistance, and it's about action fighting back. And then I'm also working on a book about the relationship between green reality, waking reality, artistic, how we interact with those on the other side. So I've got a lot of irons in that fire.
Nice. I want to jump on piggyback on what you were saying from your novel with the CEO in the trunk, and bring us to our next segment. To quote Utah Phillips, the earth is not dying, she is being killed, and those who are killing it have names and addresses. This week, the name and address is Richard Adkerson. Richard Adkerson wins the award of getting his address put out this week, and I'm not going to give his home address because I couldn't find it in the public domain, so I'm just going to give where he works. He works at 1 North Central Avenue in Phoenix, Arizona, 85004, and he is the CEO of Freeport, McMoran, Copper, and Gold. So again, the earth is not dying, she's being killed, those killing it have names and addresses. Richard Adkerson, 1 North Central Avenue, Phoenix, Arizona, 85004.
Okay, I want to say two things. I want to say two things explicitly. One of them is that Freeport McMoRan is, I don't know if it still is, but a couple years ago was the most polluting company in the entire world. They've machine gunned indigenous peoples in Papua.
Jesus.
They're very, very nasty. And having said that, I also want to say, especially since we have just talked about my novel, I want to be very explicit that I am not, that's what we said about Eric McDavid too, I am not suggesting anybody go to his office. I am not suggesting anybody put him in a trunk. I want to be very explicit that if somebody does that, that's their idea. It is not my idea. I am not taking responsibility for that.
Absolutely. Derek Jensen had nothing to do with this segment. And
No, I have something to do with this segment, but I'm – oh, with that segment, with that name. Yeah,
right.
I just want to say that especially after – I mean, because that's part of the deal with the whole Eric McDavid thing, too, is that and we need to be very, very careful. And those of us who are above ground and doing the work like you're doing and doing the work like I'm doing, we have big fucking bullseyes on our chests. And that's part of our job. is to do that. And then we also need to be extremely careful. We do live in a panopticon, and we do live in a police state for those who resist. And so that's all. I just needed to make that disclaimer so I don't get a knock on my door.
Right, and I also wanted to make it very clear that the name and address of that CEO came from Freeport McMoRan's website. I did not hire an investigator, do any deep investigative reporting. This is public information of their own website, and it's a great address to write a letter to if you'd like to do that as well.
Or even to go protest, or even to go do
I mean,
well,
just go to the website, fcx.com. Anybody out there, go to www.fcx.com. And if their own slideshow with their own captions don't enrage you, then I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, go to Fox News and enjoy your day. You know, go on a bike ride, whatever it is that's going to make you feel good or whatever. But this, if this doesn't enrage you, then maybe we're not having the same discussion.
And, Derek, one final thing. It's interesting about that company is if you go to their website, they have a link on celebrating diversity with an adorable picture of a little black girl, which is painfully, disgustingly ironic, especially when you describe them actually probably having machine gunned her family and then snapping a picture of her back at the office. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. And that's part of the deal, too. With one of the things we're working with or against, I mean, is that you know, those in power are actually quite proud of what they're doing. I mean, they're not going to feel guilty. They don't feel bad about what they're doing because what they're doing is right and just and good from their perspective. They're developing natural resources. And
absolutely. Mm-hmm. And they're able to convince everybody, not even with any effort, that what they're doing is right and just and good, to the point where people who would normally be against such things will defend it to the death.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one
death is literal. It's not. I'm not saying that as a metaphor.
I agree.
And one final thing before we take calls, I just googled this. Nerve agents such as VX and GB actually do cause you to shit your pants, including a few other things. So I knew there was shit out there that did that. So
all that keyboard hitting we've been hearing in the background the whole time has been you googling how to shit your pants.
Yeah, with nerve agents.
Dear Lord. All right, so the phone lines are open. Again, it's 646-200-3974. We've got about 5 minutes left here, so
nobody wants to talk to us.
Nobody wants to talk to maybe it's just that your books are so well written that they don't have any questions, because you actually talk about that in Endgame, how you, before you even put out this book, you spent years writing it, but before you put it out, you covered every conceivable argument, and even some that are inconceivable.
Well, thanks. I try, but it really doesn't matter because you still get people say the same old crap.
Well, and it's funny is the one line in the book that got the attention of a lot of my friends who are animal rights activists, first and foremost, which is a vital part of the resistance as well, is of the 900 pages of your work, the one line that gets you torn apart and makes you not a valid source for some of them is that. On page 802, I break open more crab legs. I don't normally eat crab, but these are destined for the dumpster anyway. And like, man, you don't get it. You haven't. You're
Wait
not reading
sec,
into
they don't
it.
Like that. I don't understand that they might not like eating meat, but they were going to be thrown away. I mean,
that can be seen as the same rationale as well. If I don't eat meat from the store, it's going to end up in the dumpster anyway.
No, because at this point, they were. Anything that's on the buffet that night, they were going to throw away.
But
so
anything on the shelf,
they should have
the
brought in
store.
Homeless people to just eat everything.
I think that's where the arguments lie. But we do have a call. Should we take
okay.
the call or should we continue picking apart?
No,
I'll
take the call.
Because I mean, we are talking about smashing the earth on our computer radio show with our telephones.
Yeah.
So let's smash the companies. We got a call. Go ahead, 314.
Hi, I was just wondering if Derek could speak to the lack of racial diversity in this movement and how it's mostly a white movement, the whole anti-civ thing. It's really discouraging for me, who's been really aware of that more recently. So I was wondering if he had any ideas on how we could be more diverse or just speak to that.
Oh, that's a great question. And I think there are a lot of indigenous peoples, we need to say that, who are anti-Civ for obvious reasons. And then, in addition, I think a lot of times one thing that we see a lot is what's called primary emergency, which is if you are an African-American and your son has been sent to prison and there's about one-third of all African-American males in this country between the ages of 18 and 35 are under so-called criminal justice supervision. That's probation, awaiting trial, whatever. And, you know, the prison system is the biggest racist gulag on the planet. And so if you're an African-American, the chances are pretty good, and you're politicized, the chances are pretty good that you might want to work around issues having to do with the prison system, having to do with police violence, having to do with economic violence against African Americans. And if you are a woman and you become politicized, chances are really good that you might want to attend to men's violence against women. That might be your primary emergency. And so the point in that is that a lot of times it's white males who have the luxury to deal with these because we aren't necessarily facing those other primary emergencies.
Wow.
And I would say just by your statistic about black males being wrapped in the judicial system, nobody understands more than the black male how powerful the violence of the judicial system can be, especially white males who historically can escape such violence. So the fear factors and the threat factor, not even just the fear factor, but the threat factor is much higher for black resistance than it is for white resistance. Via Fred Hampton gets killed in his sleep, Mark Rudd gets a publishing deal.
Huh. Yeah, that's about it, isn't it? And exactly. And I think one of the ways that we can help this movement to become more diverse is to recognize the importance of all of those other struggles, and not to hold to some sort of ideal of purity that just because something is not going to aim toward bringing down civilization that we can't support it. That I think that it can be very important to support all sorts of struggles. I've never been a big believer in the reform versus revolution dichotomy, that if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, there's not going to be anything left when we get there. And if all we do is reform work, then there's not going to be anything left because it's going to grind away. So I'm a huge believer in, as long as we keep all tactics open, as long as we're honest about our ultimate goal of also working with and not being exclusive of, I mean, I have no problem with working with to stop domestic violence, obviously, working to stop rape, working to stop the oppression of African Americans, the oppression of Latinos. I mean, Chicanos. I think that those are all very important things to do. I have no problem with somebody working to, and we have to do away with the wage economy. That's got to go. But at the same time, I got no problem with attempting to raise minimum wage.
So then the question that I would have leading on that is universal health care. Obviously, everybody needs health care. But empowering the state, who has shown its ability and capabilities to use massive amounts of violence and control, and with some of the language used in the bill, and I'm not talking about the death panels that the right wing is focusing on in the media. I'm talking about some of the other more subtle languages of control, dealing with vaccinations and with bank accounts, that's written into this bill unnecessarily. Do you still support this universal health care idea?
Honestly, this whole process has disgusted me so much that I don't know what I think about the current proposals, because I'm presuming they're all going to be bullshit. But
yeah.
Having said that,
if I may be so blunt, who gives a shit?
Having said that, I have some serious health problems, and I have been, trying to figure out how I can, marry somebody from Scotland or England or France or Canada or something like that to get me some health care. And in the meantime, in the short term, the reason I'm specifically avoiding your question is because I don't know anything about the bank account stuff that you mentioned. so I can't comment
on
that.
You just have to take my word for it.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm happy to do that. But the thing is, what I'm trying to say is that I know people in Canada who, yeah, the whole industrial health system is rotten to the core, but I know people in Canada that if I were a Canadian citizen, I would not have the problems with my Crohn's disease. Well, I'd have different problems with Crohn's disease. The Crohn's is okay right now, but I wouldn't have problems with my ankles right now. I need ankle surgeries, and I would have had these things 10 years ago if I lived in Canada. And so that's sort of the reform versus revolution question right there too. Yes, the whole industrial system needs to come down, but in the meantime, I need ankle surgery.
Right. Now, what about we talk about mutual aid and those concepts and so many other facets, but I don't hear many people talking about mutual aid when it comes to healthcare. And we do have a vast amount of people in our communities and in our groups who are nurses, who are doctors, who do have access to medications. I think that I would be remiss if I didn't mention the idea of how piracy has come into play in so many aspects throughout history to take care of its people versus the empire. And I think that that's something that we should start inspecting as well. Not that it doesn't already happen, but it should happen on a larger scale.
How would that work on a scale?
The same way that my friend who works at Domino's Pizza when we were broke would give us free pizza.
So you're talking about people basically handing out free care.
Yeah, people stealing from their hospital, people stealing from the doctor offices who they work for. Why not? I mean, you need bandages, you need health care, you need certain, especially the more minimal things. Obviously, you can't steal a surgery, but there are a lot of things that
that's
can be
thinking.
Stolen.
Right,
but you could steal a surgery if you knew a surgeon, and if that surgeon was one of these surgeons who are out there opting for the universal health care, and if the health care plan doesn't go through, then be a revolutionary. Take that change into your hands and open up your hospital.
You know, and honestly, if I were now 20 years old and interested in science, I would almost undoubtedly become a medical doctor and specialize in providing abortions for women.
Which is a real hot button topic in the Midwest right now, where I'm based.
Well, yeah, and that's why I say it is because that's what you're talking about is providing those services. We need doctors without borders in the United States.
Right. People said to me just this week, well, I said, you know, bricks are more plentiful than ballots and create much more immediate change, so cast your ballot now. And they said, well, if you're saying that it's okay for you to throw a brick through a Starbucks window or at a cop's head, then you have to say it's okay for someone to kill an abortion doctor. And I said, well, number one, no, I don't have to say that's okay. And number two, you're saying that as if they don't already kill abortion doctors.
Right.
They do.
Right. Right.
You know. So, yeah. We have no other callers coming in right now, and it looks like the time that we said that we would release you back into the woods is over.
I'd just like to say, Derek, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. I don't usually watch entire YouTube presentations because my attention span is really fucking short, and I actually sat down and watched an hour lecture by you, and I just want to say I was impressed, and it was an honest, real pleasure to be able to speak with you tonight. And I would love to buy your book, but I can't afford it.
Well, thank you for saying all that. It's been really fun, and we should do this again sometime.
Absolutely, man. We'd love to have you back.
You can check in with us whenever you'd like. Do you have any closing statements you'd like to make? Anything you'd like to send off? Any last thoughts?
Yeah, this culture is killing the planet. We need to stop the culture from doing that. Nothing
okay, any
matters,
last
really.
Thoughts other than that?
Yeah, like something cool.
something that I can vote about.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm going to a town hall meeting next week, and I want to raise some shit. So peanuts,
yeah, let's,
what?
Let's put it on the ballot to deindustrialize. here's something that actually can. Okay, even working within the system, there are some people who are doing some really good work on this. Thomas Lindsay, for example, is doing great work de-chartering corporations. And he's doing great work. There's this township in southwestern Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania, where they've actually passed rules in their county that say that you can't have factory farms. And they're not allowing, like, distant corporations to do stuff. And that's great, great, great thing to do. And, of course, they're going to lose in the state and national courts when the feds sue over these local rules. But that doesn't alter the fact that it's really great work that's being done. But I want to go back to the main point. And sorry if this isn't a cool enough thing to end on, but you know, the people who come after are not going to care about what laws we did or didn't pass. They're not going to care about what sort of compost piles we made. They're not going to care if we rode bikes. They're not going to care about what we did or did not eat crab legs. What they're going to care about is whether the land can support them. They're going to care about whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. And the most important thing is for us to stop this culture from killing the planet.
Right. Like I always say, the future generations are going to know us not by what we've created, by what we've destroyed. You know, it's your choice.
Indeed.
You're going to destroy
yeah.
one thing, so you got to choose between you know, the oceans or the ocean liners.
Well, and that's another thing is that so many, and I'm not accusing either one of you of this, but so many pacifists, for example, think that inaction absolves you of responsibility, but that's just not true. But if we stand by and let this happen, we're responsible. We are culpable for this, not because we participate in the system, but because we don't bring it down. That's why we're culpable.
Right.
Amen, brother. You're right.
Absolutely, and if you ever mention my name or my presence and the word pacifist in the same sentence again, we're going to have serious words, Mr. Jensen.
Okay, yeah, you can pull out your two-handed plus two sword of pacifist slang and then
yes!
the D20.
I have no idea what you just said.
Well,
but I do, and that's all that matters.
English, and now you're speaking some jumble jumble.
And I love that shit has stuck with you from childhood until now.
Yeah.
My God. Well, thanks, Derek, for joining us. I hope you get to have sex soon.
Thanks. I hope you have a great night.
Yeah,
take care, Derek.
And
okay,
oh, it's www.derekjensen.com.
Org.
E-E-R-org.
Dot com is a former Marine.
Oh.
That's right, it is. I have gone to this site. That's really weird.
That's
okay, www.derekjensen.org, and that's DERICKJENSEN.ORG.
And I will
post
that.
He's going to be speaking at. He does a lot of talks all over the country. So check him out if he's going to be in your neighborhood. Swing by and give him some shit and have a good time. Right?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Have a great night. Bye.
You too.
All right. That was Derek Jensen, everybody. And I just want to say, if you didn't call in and you had the chance, you're an idiot.
Yeah, you stupid sons of bitches.
Because you just forced myself and G20 to uphold a conversation with this guy all by ourselves. And we're sycophants. It's you can't expect a sycophant to challenge somebody whom they love. I mean, that's in one of his books, actually.
Well, what do we got? We got about 6 minutes until we are going to play This Week in Radical History. So what do we want to talk about in the meantime?
Well, actually, let's throw a song down really quick. And I do want to mention to everybody that Derek's books are available in most libraries. And if they're not, talk to your librarian and get them to order them for you. Or, you know, talk to your local anarchist collective. They're everywhere. Go to slingshot.tal.org, and you can find an anarchist collective or radical resistance group in your area. And undoubtedly someone there will have something by Jensen to loan you. But you want to hear a song?
Yeah, let's play a song.
Okay, we got a choice here. We got something talking about two different various levels of the underground. You know, we played David Robicks last week. Let's throw it out to our peeps in all Spanish-speaking countries who are fighting for resistance. This is Manu Chao, and it goes out to Nate.
Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dice en el clandestino por no llevar papel. Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice la autoridad. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quebra ley.
mano negra clandestina, peruano clandestino, africano clandestino, marihuana ilegal. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena, correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón, me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Argelino clandestino, nigeriano clandestino, boliviano clandestino, mano negra ilegal.
Between him and Jensen.
Yeah.
Did you think that was part of the song?
Yeah, I was like, what the fuck? What? The? I've heard Manu Chao.
It was actually an accident that came into play. My switchboard here only works on one function, that's play or stop, and I accidentally clicked on the play for Chicken Dance as opposed to
nice.
The stop on Clandestino, which stopped it, would have stopped it at the end of Clandestino, and the Chicken Dance is alphabetically right next to Clandestino, and so I apologize. And to be honest, there's absolutely no good reason why we have Chicken Dance loaded into our soundboard.
No, there's really not. We load a lot of shit into there. Rabble, you want to real quick tell the listeners who have stayed with us who we got next week?
I will, actually. We have John Taylor Gatto, and John Taylor Gatto is he's actually listed as one of the influences to our last caller, as well as thousands of people in this country who choose to homeschool. He was the Teacher of the Year for New York City and New York State, and he's written many good books since that time, basically saying that the school is a prison system. He'll be joining us next week. I'm actually going to play a short clip by John Taylor Gatto right now, and as soon as this clip is done, we're going to go into This Week in Radical History, and that will end us out for the night. So this is Rabble Rouser saying thanks for coming.
And this is G20. Thanks, everyone, so much for listening. And even though Derek Jensen is the hope crusher, be sure to keep it alive, people.
Yeah, we didn't need to do much liberal bashing or hope crushing. It kind of
sucks. No, I know. We'll get to it. We have plenty of shows coming.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we can handle that on our own. We don't need Jensen's approval.
Indeed.
But this is John Taylor Gatto, everybody, followed by Mike Cannon's This Week in Radical History. Thanks so much
Good
for
night.
Joining us.
On the verbal, Bush graduated from Yale with a mediocre score, and Bradley graduated from Princeton with a horrible score. One became a governor, the other a senator, and one's now the president. I guess you think Al Gore's an exception. No, he flunked out of college his freshman year, flunking 6 of the 7 courses he took. Why doesn't the New York Times put that in banner headlines on the front cover? If you can be a senator, a governor, a vice president, and a president with this horrible academic record, why can't you be anything else?
See in your future Mercury.
A federal government study that looked at the levels of mercury in fish in 291 rivers and streams throughout the country found that in all the samples taken, that's all the samples taken from all of the streams, there was mercury in fish taken from all of these streams in throughout the country. And then in about one quarter to one third of the samples, the mercury levels exceeded amounts that the EPA recommends for human consumption. I should note that while the EPA sets a limit on the amount of mercury that humans should consume, there are many environmentalists and many doctors who recommend a level of zero consumption for mercury, since it is such a potent neurotoxin. So I found that particularly disturbing, that there is nowhere in the United States that is safe from mercury levels in fish. And I should also point out that the Bush administration is directly responsible for this as the leading cause of mercury contamination in the food supply is from coal-fired power plants. They've blocked many attempts to limit mercury levels, mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants.
Gonna rise up and take what's there. But finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
From the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios, this is This Week in Radical History for the week starting August 24th. Inspiration for this little ditty comes from the Slingshot calendar organizer, and much of the historical radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the East Side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey,
hey. This week in radical history, I only have one item for August 24th, 1967. Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin throw 300 $1 bills from the balcony onto the floor of the New York Stock Exchange to disrupt business as usual. It worked, creating instant bedlam as people scramble for the bucks. Hoffman received a master's degree in psychology from the University of California at Berkeley and is a co-founder of the Youth International Party, YIP, tried in the Chicago 7 trial, author of several books including Steal This Book and Revolution for the Hell of It. He committed suicide in 1989. To quote Abbie Hoffman, "Sacred cows make the best handle."
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
The line must be drawn here.
Yes, I'm a nerd, and for all you Star Trek fans out there, ever wonder in the Voyager series where the term Marquis came from? You know, the underground group fighting against the Federation? Well, the Marquis were the French resistance group fighting the Nazi occupation during World War II. Many of the Marquis were Spanish anarchists who took control of Paris after the Nazis fled on August 25th in 1944. Also, on August 25th, 1950, President Harry Truman orders U.S. Army to seize all the nation's railroads to prevent the nationwide strike to happen. The railroads are not returned to their owners until 2 years later. However, of course, the profits were always returned to their owners. Also on that date in 1968, the Battle of Lincoln Park Democratic Convention in Chicago, with demonstrations and police riots. 10,000-plus demonstrators versus 11,000 Chicago police, 6,000 National Guard, and 7,500 U.S. Army troops, as well as 1,000 FBI, CIA, and Army Navy Intelligence Service agents participated. The world would see what democracy looks like as the government beats and tear gases the protesters. Lastly, for August 25, 1985, the White House confirms that Ronald Reagan was an FBI informant with his own Secret Service number in Hollywood in the late 1940s while heading up the Screen Actors Guild. How many names do you think this Fink named while he's being paid to protect the actors he's in charge of? This Week in Radical History for August 26th, 1786, Shays' Rebellion, armed insurrection begins in western Massachusetts. Armed local farmers upset about the draconian debt laws that often put farmers in debtor's prison and the government taking their lands, host an uprising against the government. For months, they successfully stopped local courts from holding debtor's trials until the government raised its own army and put down the rebellion by force. More rebellion occurred on 1913 in Dublin as the 1913 lockout in Dublin happens, when tram drivers left their cars in the middle of the road during a bourgeoisie horse show week. Workers around Dublin had horrid living conditions due to poor wages. 26,000 families lived in 5,000 tenement buildings, which gave rise to the highest infant mortality rate in Europe, among numerous other problems. The Dublin factories locked out the workers, who at the end were in the brink of starvation, destroying the union in hopes for higher wages and better living standards. Also on August 26, 1919, more labor unrest. United Mine Workers, UWM, organizer Fannie Sellins is gunned down by company-bought sheriffs during the Pennsylvania coal strikes. She had been a witness to the beating and death of a fellow union organizer. The newspaper report stated, "The mine official snatched a club and felled the woman to the ground. This was not on company ground, but just outside the fence. She rose and tried to drag herself. The official shouted, 'Kill that, blank.' Three shots were fired, each taking effect. She fell to the ground, and the official cried, 'Give her another.' One of the deputies, standing over the motionless and silent body, held his gun down and without averting his face, fired into the body that did not move. One of the deputies picked up the woman's hat, placed it on his head, danced and stepped, and said to the crowd, 'I'm Mrs. Sellins now.'" Lastly, for August 26, 1968, the National Student Association reports 221 major college protests against the Vietnam War held nationwide since January of that year. This Week in Radical History for August 27th, only got a couple items. 1927, thousands turn out in violent protests over the deaths of Sokko and Zetti in Paris after two U.S. courts find the two anarchists guilty of firebombing in a trial that would give kangaroos a bad name. Dozens of other protests erupt around the world. Also on August 27, 1988, George Bush Sr. says that atheists should not be considered for U.S. citizenship. Lastly, in 1992, Catholic Church apologized to Indians for the Spanish conquest. Well, better late than never, I guess. A couple years ago, the Catholic Church also apologized for its involvement in support of the Nazis and the Holocaust. And, of course, a couple years ago, the Catholic Church also apologized for the molestation by their priests. How Christian of them. Perhaps George Sr. should have insisted that Catholics can't be considered for citizenship. This Week in Radical History for August 28, 1926 in Nicaragua, for the umpteenth time, Marines land at Blue Fields to protect American interests. On this date in 1927, Ashes to Ashes, as Sekko and Vizetti funeral is held from the north end to Forest Hill Cemetery. The anarchists are cremated. In September, all Hollywood newsreels of Sekko and Vizetti are ordered destroyed by William Hayes, Hollywood movie czar. Here is a brief report about Sekko and Vizetti's memorial held in Boston.
Emperor Norton's stationary marching band provided a contrary effective atmosphere to somber issues of immigrant rights, death penalty, state repression, and the memories of Sacco and Vanzetti.
Well, I'm out here to commemorate the 81st anniversary of the murder of two comrades, Sacco and Vanzetti, and to keep their memories alive. And if their memories are alive, they are.
Why do you think it's important to keep their memories alive?
Because what happened 81 years ago is happening today, all in our streets. Right today in Boston at the Caribbean Festival, where the cops are importing Irish police to conduct surveillance on the crowd goers because of the ICE raids in which our elected officials cooperate.
No more immigration. It
was a motley crew of 50 to 60 dedicated anarchists that marched from Copley Square to the streets of downtown Boston to the North End. Red, anarchist, and black flags were waving in the breeze. A large banner of Sacco and Vanzetti led the march. This was the day, August 23rd, 2008, that marked the 81st anniversary of their execution.
I was just talking to a bunch of Italian tourists who were wondering, you know, why do we care about Sacco and Vanzetti? Why are we doing this for the Italians?
That was the question I was about to ask you. Why focusing on Sacco and Vanzetti?
Well, Sacco and Vanzetti are a really, really important part of anarchist history to begin with, but especially the history of revolutionaries in Boston. The Italian anarchist movement in this country was really strong at that time, and we're trying to bring back the anarchist movement to be what it once was and then more. We want a revolution, so great.
Molly Olderstein of BAM. She also works with the Lucy Parsons Center and later addressed the rally at the North End.
An extremely important thing to remember today on the anniversary of their execution is that the case of Sacco and Vanzetti is not some past aberration of our criminal justice system. We can't just look back and remember and breathe a sigh of relief, because this is how our criminal justice system operates. If anything, it gets worse with time, if only because it has become so pervasive that it seems normal now. From 1956 to 1971, COINTELPRO used similar surveillance, disruption, and entrapment tactics on a number of movements, from civil rights groups and the Black Panther Party to socialist and anti-war groups. Currently, to name just a few examples, immigrants, minority communities, and environmental activists are being heavily targeted in the same way. Like in the time of Sacco and Vanzetti, the state uses war in order to scare the general population into submitting to whatever security measures that it deems necessary to protect itself. Then it was World War I, and now it's a stream of never-ending wars. The war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on terror. If we ever get out of Iraq, there's sure to be another country ripe for the occupation. Iran sure is looking like a good prospect. The media certainly doesn't help in making us so afraid of each other that we've submitted to living in a police state. We need to open our eyes and start taking control of our own lives, our own communities, our own media, and our own security. We need to realize that the news on the TV and in the papers is not our own, but a perverted, biased, and censored version of reality designed to keep us scared and in the dark, grasping tightly onto the state, a venomous barbed wire slicing into our hands and poisoning our minds. We can create our own media. There are already projects out there that you can plug into, or you can start your own. If we want to truly honor these fallen comrades, we must continue their work and the work of so many others who are now dead or imprisoned who dare to fight against the exploitation of the state. If we continue the struggle, Sacco and Vanzetti live!
Bells from the old North End church chimed as the anarchists held their rally across the street. This program was recorded, mixed, and edited by your announcer, Chuck Rosina, for the Boston Community Reporters Project. Thanks to Freeman T for providing technical support, and thank you for listening.
Also on August 28, 1931, the Italian government requires university teachers to take a pledge of allegiance to fascism. Why bother? Of the 1,200, only a dozen teachers refuse, and they are fired. The moral and critical bankruptcy of the intellectuals at universities and their pathetic submission to the state power and will is, as always, demonstrated once again. Also on August 28, 1955, while visiting family in Mooney, Mississippi, African-American teenager Emmett Till is brutally murdered after speaking, quote, inappropriately, unquote, to a white woman. The questionable trial that follows and Mrs. Till's decision to display her son's mutilated remains during an open casket funeral helped to mobilize opposition to segregation in America. Lastly, on this date in 1968, Chicago FBI agents report Ginsburg chanted unintelligently poems in Grant Park. Unintelligible poem was William Blake's The Gray Monk. This Week in Radical History for August 29, 1911, Ishii, the last Stone Age man in America, surrenders in Northern California. Of the 2,000 members of his tribe alive in 1864, only 15 were alive in 1865. The rest were killed by the whites. For a good book on Ishii, read Ishii in Two Worlds. Also on August 29, 1968, Chicago police continued to brutally attack demonstrators, reporters, and bystanders at the Democratic National Convention. The whole world is watching. The official investigation later termed this a police riot. As of that date, 27,508 Americans had died in Vietnam since January 1st of 1961. In another land based on freedom on this date in 2000, the Australian government says it will restrict visits by UN human rights inspectors because of its criticism of the treatment of their Aborigines. Lastly on this date, Hurricane Katrina hits the south, destroying much of New Orleans, where upwards of 50,000 mostly poor African Americans were unable to escape. At the end of this piece, I'll have a short montage of interviews I got while I was down in New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina hit. This day in radical history for August 30th, this was caught on film in 1979. President Jimmy Carter, attacked by a rabbit on a canoe trip on April 20th in Plains, Georgia, finally makes the headlines. Those rascally rabbits. If you ever get a chance, try to view this footage as a Secret Service man tries to beat down this rabbit with an oar as it tries to jump in the boat with Jimmy Carter.
What's an ordinary rabbit? That's the most foul, cruel, and bad-tempered rodent you ever set eyes on.
Run away! Run away! Run away!
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I've many friends. And some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper. There were three of us this morning. I'm the only one this evening, but I must go on. The frontiers are my prison.
This has been This Week in Radical History. This being the anniversary of Katrina, I end the show with a short montage of interviews from some radicals that flocked down there to help out right after the storm hit. This week's show is dedicated to all their efforts. Until next week, a reminder that I'm always with you, always yours in a struggle. Mike Cannon.
Then we'll come from shadow.
As some of you may know, I went down to New Orleans recently and interviewed some residents and activists of that devastated area. I plugged into the Common Ground Collective, and you can check them out at commongroundrelief.org. That's commongroundrelief.org. To close my show today, I'll have this five-minute montage of those interviews.
We're not just down here for a couple months. We're working here to make this into a permanent clinic here in the community that's run by community members and controlled by community members. And it's a long process, and it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of money. So if folks want to help out, this is a place to do it.
Of all the problems of racism and classism that were existing down here before, what happened down here was whole series of human rights violations against people of the Gulf Coast was perpetrated by the city, state, and federal government in conjunction with many national and international-based relief organizations.
That lack of organization from the government and what they're kind of where they're falling through, what you've seen where they fall through at?
Well, from what I've seen, it seems to be very bureaucratic in terms of getting supplies to any of the relief centers. You have to bear to prove your ID of residency. You need to prove that you're from the area, and most people have lost most of the paperwork since Katrina and Rita have hit, that they don't have the proper paperwork to provide to show that they're a resident. And without that, and you go to a federally run relief center, your chances of getting supplies are next to nothing.
It's the class war that's being waged down here, and that folks around the country have to remember that just because, you know, CNN or Fox News is saying, oh, all services are 100% open down here, that's a crock of shit. I mean, you walk around in a, you know, 10 square block area and you'll see that, you know, half to two-thirds of the businesses still aren't open. And it's a matter of blatant lies being perpetrated in, you know, against the people of New Orleans, saying, oh, they're all hunky-dory now, where there are whole neighborhoods that don't have power, that don't have water.
A friend of mine that works for Palestine Indy Media, that has been in Palestine for long periods of time, repeated visits, said that she felt like this was Palestine. Between the military checkpoints and the curfews that would change on a whim of the authorities, the curfews, you'd get a different answer whoever you asked, because there were no military, there were no police here, in some places for the first 3, 6 to 8 days, depending on what specific neighborhood and who you ask. There was none of that presence on the ground. And then as soon as the military was here, they were acting like the checkpoints were necessary to keep out looters. I was like, you missed the boat, you're too late, you're lying, you're hypocritical, you're just wrong.
It's really important that people get down here if they can. I mean, I know everyone's busy. I know everyone has a lot of things they need to do with their time. But this is a place where people are needed. I know that the Red Cross and FEMA are saying they don't need more bodies. And the reason that they're saying that is because they don't want people coming down here. They don't want people to know what they're doing. They don't want people to see the atrocities that are being committed every day. They don't want people to see the damage. They don't want people to really realize the war that's being waged right now, the war for New Orleans that's being fought.
I spent a long time researching who the owners were. I come back down here, and I'm told one of the women who wasn't at our meetings had been intimidated and forced to give over her key, and her and her four children were out on the street, and she was crying. And we can't get in contact with that woman. We wish we could. So here we've got these landlords that are going around the law and certainly going around what's right and bullying, intimidating, bluffing people out. They've already got construction crews over here, contractors, all these things, and they're telling 75-year-old women that they might get hit by trucks. It's just, you know, veiled threats, and it's just unacceptable.
Around here, I look in an apartment, they say $1,000 for deposit, $1,000 for rent. I am a personal clean house. The people not come back yet. I don't have enough money for pay that apartment's very expensive for me. I don't have place to go.
The need is still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times full that in huge swaths of this town, like in the 9th Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So thanks again for all your efforts, and Common Ground's an awesome place, and I hope people get a chance to come down and check it out, and at least check out the website at commongroundrelief.org.
Then we'll come from shadows.